for the record, put down here, I'm talking to Jack Nessel on this, was it 15th, 16th of March, 1995. What I want to do is start by asking you the same question I've asked everybody else, which has turned out to be a very productive question, which is...
I'll be the exception.
How did you first happen to become involved with KPFA?
Well, actually, I was let go from a job as the public relations director of a construction company, a very ambitious building contractor named Eichler, who had an innovative kind of house that he built in quantity in the Bay Area. He had his own public relations department.
Eichler House.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I never knew that you were involved with that.
Well, it was
but I knew in a general way.
It was literally my first paid job, seeing as how my parents didn't make me work when I was in school. I had this job. He decided to go out of the house and hire an agency. And so I and his advertising director, who was my boss, were let go, sacked. And I needed a job. I was living in San Francisco. I was 23 years old or so, maybe 22, I can't remember. An old high school friend named John Leonard, who is, to jump ahead 40 years or so, now married to my ex-wife, who was my wife at the time that we're talking about my affiliation with KPFA, had been the drama and literature director of KPFA. Having sold his first novel, was ready to pack up and move from Berkeley to New York. Thus,
The Naked Martini.
Yeah, thus vacating his job. And he suggested to me that I would be not only qualified, but eminently qualified to go and take his job if I could put up with the attendant problems, and not knowing anything about the attendant problems, but knowing that I needed a job.
You hadn't worn a hair shirt before, so you didn't know what it felt like.
No, that's right. It sounded good to me. I went over, and he couldn't give me the job. He could only recommend me for it. So I met the station manager, who was Trevor Thomas, who didn't seem to ask me any questions that seemed to me productive insofar as he could judge my qualifications as a drama and literature director, but he did talk amiably to me and said, well, John recommends you, and there was somebody else that I was interested in, but she is leaving the country, so would you like the job? The job turned out to be a half-time, not a full-time job initially. It subsequently became a full-time job. And I can't remember whether at the very beginning I was folio editor, which is program guide, as well as drama and literature director, but I think so. Certainly that was what I ended up doing, was editing the monthly program guide. Being the programming
director.
Was it
monthly by that point and not bi-weekly?
Was it? Well, John, you know, the truth is...
That's a mistake.
Yeah,
ignore it.
Yeah, the truth is I don't remember. I always thought it was monthly, but it could have been bi-weekly.
I think it was bi-weekly and became monthly later on.
Yeah,
it
certainly could have been.
Anyway.
Well, there is, jumping around for the moment, a point to be made there with reference to my own subsequent career, and that is that while being drama and literature director was of some small value, being folio editor was of considerable value to me in the future, because it was the first time that I really got to thoroughly run a publication, as limited as it may seem. In fact, I wrote or rewrote almost every program description in there, and they were small paragraphs often instead of just the news or whatever.
Yeah.
And I tried to infuse, especially the programs that I did, with the descriptions of them with a certain amount of style and wit. And my idea of being a rebel in Berkeley at the time was really to be counter-revolutionary. I mean, to make fun of the very things that the station seemed to, or its more humorless subscribers seemed to take seriously. So I got to be a wise ass, in other words, and it was really quite useful.
Your predecessor had been a wise ass before you, so he'd paved the way.
And he knew another one when he saw one. I was able to, for example, start writing contents pages back in New York City at the Herald Tribune without even thinking about it, because the contents page of a weekly magazine is nothing but a small version of the program guide KPFA. Small advertisements for the programs or for the articles. Anyway, I got this as a half-time job, John, and stayed there through the notorious strike, and then came back and finished up there for another year or so and left for New York. I guess a total of less than 3 years.
Mm-hmm. One is not supposed to ask leading questions, but since this isn't a trial, and a judge is not going to slap my hands, I'll do it anyway. I have a memory of you having said, after you had been in New York for a while, at even at New York Magazine, that going to New York from KPFA and anticipating the cutthroat competition of the New York scene, that after what you had been through at KPFA, you found New York to be virtually a collection of degenerates, sort of members of a religious order.
Yeah, no. I actually thought that I was in Erewhon or one of these utopian places in New York City after Berkeley. I mean, I was there in Berkeley at a particularly tumultuous time intellectually and culturally and around the station politically, so that may not have been typical of life in Berkeley. I mean, I just might have been there at that crucial moment where everyone was on one side or another, and the two sides were Machiavellian and vicious. But yes, I did say that.
Yeah. Well, did you have? Can you say anything about your first impressions when you came to work at the station?
Well, I should really just cut to the chase and tell you what my overall impression is, and it's in retrospect, and then we can get back to the immediate time. That is that. Just as youth is far too wonderful to be wasted on the young, a career is a job at KPFA was far too wonderful to have been wasted on a 22, 23-year-old. I had no sense whatsoever of just how much freedom to do amazingly wonderful things I had, and how rare the opportunity is to be able to do these things and actually see them materialize, get them broadcast. There are so many obstacles to getting a book published or an article published or a magazine started or a film made or what you will, that the idea that I could walk in at 22, 23 years old, and without a budget, to be sure, nevertheless, otherwise, just produce whatever I wanted and get it put on the radio. I mean, it struck me as, gee, this is sort of nice. What shall I do tomorrow? But it's like unthinkably wonderful, and that I've never had that kind of freedom since, and probably few people have ever had it at all. I was constrained only by not having any money to pay for the rights to things, and sometimes that didn't stop me, because I stole them. I pirated. Mm-hmm. Just did scripts without authorization.
Yes, no, we worried. We weren't big enough for anybody to catch us to court.
Yeah, I mean, I learned pretty early that I shouldn't offer these to the New York station because there they might be heard by agents or whatever. But otherwise, we did some pretty good radio plays. Was able to interview all sorts of interesting authors and ask them, the kinds of questions that probably they'd never heard in interviews before, but they were ready to answer. I mean, because they weren't polite questions, you know. And again, mm-hmm. I was just too young to know the difference. And there wasn't really, in those days, a tradition of talk shows or anything. No. This all came much, mm-hmm. much later. Yeah. You could ask people about their political pasts if that was relevant to their literary oeuvre. And they would they'd actually answer. And a lot of that is great source material, I would think, for biographers, if it could ever be rooted out. We had some wonderful writers and novelists, poets, filmmakers, whatever, on the air back then.
One of the most important things was that people who came into the station who were used to being interviewed by the media were not used to being asked intelligent questions.
That's right. So they liked it
and
kept talking.
And they blossomed.
Absolutely.
When suddenly there was somebody that was actually interested in something other than what they had for breakfast or what their favorite color was.
Yeah, yeah. This is so. I can only remember one really embarrassing moment in retrospect. I failed completely to understand what Betty Friedan was talking about when she came to the station. And both Elsa Thompson, the public affairs director, and I interviewed her. And
yeah, I remember it.
Elsa wasn't interested enough to do it herself. Normally, it would not have been an interview that I would have participated in because it wasn't literary. But there I was, just totally in the dark about what Friedan was trying to say about women's liberation, and that her book had just come out, I mean, just minutes before, which means that I was the very pig that she was addressing indirectly in the book, I suppose. What is it that, I don't understand what it is that women have been, women are complaining about, or something like that.
Well, now, I was out there recording that interview.
Yeah, no doubt.
And my memory of it was I wrote her off at that time as an extremely commercial woman.
I thought that too. I thought she was just simply pitching a book without really a lot of personal passion in back of it.
Has your opinion altered?
Well, I mean, certainly it was the birth of the women's liberation movement, and as such, it was a much more culturally significant moment than I ever recognized. Mm-hmm. And that's all that's the only way it's altered. I mean, my feelings about Betty Friedan as a prophet, mm-hmm. Really haven't altered that much. I don't think she's any more interesting now than I thought then. Mm-hmm. But I just failed to grasp the historical significance of it. Mm-hmm. Even as I failed to grasp the historical significance of the sit-ins at Woolworth when I was back at Harvard Law School, and I passed by and I said, you know, this is really wonderful and idealistic, and I wish I could do it, but of course it'll never come to anything.
My whole time in Berkeley, I look back on seeing myself very much as J. Wesley Smith. From all those marvelous Saturday Review cartoons.
Yeah.
The guy who was there didn't have the foggiest idea what was going on.
I think a good deal went over our head. But on the other hand, we got to do a lot of things. Remember the one-shot programs that we did? This was after the strike, and I was feeling very mischievous and looking to just spoof everything and anything that people took seriously. You and I and Scott Keach and a few others got up to the studio way late after everyone else had left. And I had assembled a bunch of tapes that we started taking fragments from and mixing and juxtaposing and doing sound effects to spoof everything from Yevtushenko's poetry reading, where we had him talking about the music of Russian church bells, followed by an enormous belch, which sounded as if it was coming right out of his mouth.
Do you have any of those?
I think I have some reel-to-reel stuff, some reels that probably have moldered by now. But,
well, not necessarily. That was taken off of a reel just now. I did it. Just before you were
on. I think I've got a couple, three that I can't play because I don't have any real machines.
I'll make a deal with you.
I'd be happy. You'll give me the reels.
I'll send you a cassette.
It's a deal. I don't even know if they're funny anymore, but they got nice reviews at the time, as I remember it, and were funny. They were just half an hour programs of pure sound collages and spoofs of Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And Berkeley values. We had
that was
Berkeley politicians speaking and questions from the audience in Russian.
That was a tradition at the station, though. Some of the best people had done delightful things spoofing it and making fun of it. And of course, John Lennon's Night Sounds
was a predecessor, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And then Charles Scheer, after I had left, went on to do a sort of a Dada effort called the Something Paris Road, the something being town. Down in Provence area, I can't remember the name of it at the moment, but it was a sort of not laid back, easygoing, free association sort of thing, in which not totally unlike the spirit of early Bunuel and Lucien Daugre or Elage d'Or.
Well, there's no radio like that around anymore, I can tell you. But again, we had no sense of the fact that we were doing anything that was all that interesting or significant culturally. We were just doing programs from day to day to fill radio time, following our own interests and our assumption that we had audiences whose interests were similar to our own. This myth of homogeneity.
And that was what Lou Hill set out.
Sure. But as second generation KPFA staff member, I really missed all the theory and came only just in time to have fun and get paid a small amount for doing it.
The theory was sound in the sense that the place having been set up, it pulled out the things which it was supposed to do. You haven't had a chance to look at that thing of mine yet.
I haven't had a chance, no.
Yeah.
I read it on the plane. Theory with sound reminds me of a Peter Sellers sketch, and they're doing a book review panel at the BBC, and a sketch about it.
The critics.
Someone says, "Well, your view is sound." I think it was on that. Maybe it was on something else. It was your view is sound. All sound.
All sound. Yes. All sound. All sound.
Anyway, we had a number of radio dramas. Remember, and you were involved in virtually all of them, I think, as the production director. We had Orson Welles' Moby Dick production.
It's there.
Yeah, which was quite good.
And
Pantaglaze.
That was a theater company from Marin or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it was started by a fellow whose wife was the daughter of one of the founders of the Gate Theater in Dublin. And I knew all of this in theory, but I had no idea what the significance of the Gate Theater in Dublin was until years later.
And there was that lovely production we did of Maeterlinck's The Intruder.
That was very nice, yeah. And
I've got that too.
I just took that right out of a textbook that I had, that script, and cast it with very good actors who happened to be around the station at the time. I think you were not involved in the Pantaglaze, which I liked a lot. It was a Gelderud play that I subsequently saw in New York, and the production actually struck me as being inferior to the one that we put on the radio in Berkeley. After all, who else is doing Gelderud?
I was involved in another Gelderud production, Red Magic.
Yes, exactly. I remember that.
Yeah, and that was one in which Virginia Maynard came back out of retirement, that were and directed, and it was the first chance that I ever had to work with her as her production director, and she had such a reputation for being so difficult. I found her so easy, and I discovered that, sort of like Elsa, the more competent you were, the easier you found it to get along with her.
Actually, it's true straight through. What else did we do? I mean, we did Sir Gawain and the Green Knight in Middle English, but we did it with charming actors who really gave personality to...
And it was that great guy from the English chap,
department at Berkeley, Cal. Paul Peeler was
Paul
his Peeler, name,
that's
as a matter of fact. And it was a labor of love with him. And he supplied the cast. I had nothing to do with
it. That's right. And there was one guy in the cast who was a Middle English scholar at Berkeley who had been an actor before.
He was the Green Knight. He had a beautiful, rounded voice. Did that thing get... That got actually nominated for a... what do you call them? The awards for best radio programs of the year.
Really?
It's not a DuPont, but they're still giving them out. Radio, I can't remember what it's called back in the States, but...
my goodness.
It was a very well regarded production,
With original score by Peter Winkler.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
I've got Peter Winkler's raw music tapes here. Yep. I couldn't bear to throw them away.
And we had an original music score. It was really something.
Remember the ad that I did for a fun drive based on it one point with two quick excerpts from it. And preceded by a tag, sex and violence, both available in Middle English on KPFA.
That's wonderful. Absolutely. Absolutely. And we did comedy, our little bringing the committee in to do some of their routines. Interspersed with the interview, and
now,
I remember
your memory of that is different from mine. I don't remember them coming over. I remember us going to them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that could be. But I remember interviewing them.
On location.
That could be. That could be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With the kitchen noises.
What I do remember is that I had first gone to see them just by myself or with my wife. And thought, gee, they'd be wonderful on the radio. Mm-hmm. I'd gone to see them as a spectator and never thought about it. And then called them and got their consent to do interviews and things. And
we went
some
over
of their
we
material.
Spent the evening. I've got very definite memories of this.
Did we actually record
the show? As it was going on. Because audience response in the background
and
all the rest of it.
Great. Actually, I'd love it.
Now, do you not have a copy of
that? No, I don't. I would love one.
Oh,
I would love a cassette of that.
You'll get it.
Because that's really funny. As I told you the other day, I still tell friends who are professional gag writers for sitcoms about that blackout where you're a very sick man. What is it, doctor? Tell me. The slightest emotional shock can kill you. It's the funniest blackout I've ever seen. Another thing that I remember vividly is you and I going off to the hardship duty of recording Lenny Bruce over and over again in the city in performance.
Because off Broadway.
Yeah.
To protect him in case.
Exactly. He wanted
him
recorded.
Those are those tapes, the part of them, the ones that I sent to you, the ones that survived.
He wanted his shows recorded so that a cop wouldn't do his act in court. He could produce it as it was.
Now remember? I didn't say that. Yeah.
Well, he used to say, the cop would say, the judge would say, well, what was this performance? And the cop would say, well, I've taken notes, and here it is, Lenny Bruce in essence, right? Cocksucker, son of a bitch, Catholic Church, fuck, you know.
Fuck the judge.
Right, you know. And he said, I just want to be protected, exactly. Yeah. And so we recorded him and put them on the air with some judicious editing, I'm afraid.
Yeah. But, God, you know, I remember one of those visits, we were sort of out in the back alley with Lenny.
Yes.
And Al Bessig.
Yes.
And this guy was in terrible shape.
I remember too, yeah.
And I was thinking, oh, God. how long has he got?
Well, he just, he was needful at the moment, I guess. What did he say on stage? Let's see, it's an IRS form. Can I deduct my toilet as an office because I use it to get high? And because he hadn't gone to the toilet when we, but we talked and walked with Lenny in those days.
Yeah. Was, Jesus, God, amazing. But you know, one of my favorite sentences that you'll encounter in that in that thing when you read it is that you're mentioned, by the way. but you're mentioned in the context of, I do a sort of a rundown of the people who were running the New York cultural scene yes. in the mid-1960s, who were ex-KPFA people.
It's true.
My comment is that they were able to achieve so much at KPFA, not because they were uniquely talented, but because they could afford the luxury of habitual integrity.
Yes, well, I whatever it was that I did at KPFA, I really had no sense of its, you know, being a great opportunity, and I had no sense of its, having any cultural significance. It was just, here I was, and I had this job. And no one told me what to do, so I got to do things that interested me.
We were as lucky. It was
incredibly naive.
We were as lucky in our own way as those people in the 1920s and into the early 30s who hung around Paris, dashing off paintings and trading them for meals at cafes.
Painting the columns at La Coupole for meals, yeah.
It is such a wonderful gift not to be taken seriously at a certain stage.
Well, I think it really helps to be unself-conscious. Now I'm conscious of everything to a fault. In those days, we just worked.
Yeah.
And the work itself was better for the lack of our understanding that it fit into any kind of context.
Yeah. What life was about was what we were doing.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder what opportunities exist right now that might be comparable to that.
Well, I think, and not just because I'm an old fogey, I think very, very few indeed. The thing that springs immediately to most people's minds, or at least in a certain cast, is the pop scene, but that has become so totally under the control of economic managers, and so completely invented that there's no it's no analogy at all.
No, there's a lot of talent there, but I think it's manipulated from day one.
Yes, and there's a lot of absence of talent, and the manipulation takes place in such a way that it's very difficult to tell the difference.
Mm. And somehow in film, extraordinary people occasionally are able to get things done, And film is a hell of a lot more expensive than radio, so it's more of a miracle by far than what we did.
Yeah.
The idea, I mean, as somebody who used to work for my wife as a writer on a trade publication magazine, an American bookseller, managed to beg, borrow, and steal enough to make a feature film. I mean, he must have made it for $25,000 or $30,000 or something, and it got shown at the Sundance Festival, which is a Robert Redford film festival in Colorado. And it became, it won the audience favorite award and was released commercially and was very successful, and the guy is now making a major film as a result of it. But the thing that he did was strictly his own. I mean, nobody told him what to do. Nobody said, you can't do this, you can't do that. It was actually a comedy about a boy having an incestuous relationship with his mother. But it was a comedy. And it was wonderful. You know, it was called Spanking the Monkey, which is also funny. But David Russell, who was the guy, I think he probably didn't have a sense of just how extraordinary it was that he was able to do this either. He was too busy, trying to, beg, borrow, and steal money to get it done. Mm-hmm. So, that's...
There's a Dutch television director that I have met a couple of times, spent some time with. Whom nobody has heard of, or will hear of, I'm afraid, named Jaap Drupsteen. And he doesn't do features. He's a sort of an animation specialist, but it's not drawing animation. It's television. Computer-derived animation combined with live actors. And he did a sequence of three short plays of Gertrude Stein, which I would unhesitatingly say is the most imaginative use of computer television technology that I have ever seen. And the voice and the music of these three plays was done by a Dutch girl who's something of a reputation as a pop star. But with a hell of a brain, she composed and performed all of the music for it, which is extremely complex. She also did all of the voices, male and female. The male voices were electronically altered by the lowering of pitch so as to be convincing. And she, by trial and error, adjusted her voice so that when the pitch alteration took place, it didn't sound like this sort of funny artificial voice, but sounded like a completely natural male voice. And something like a year was spent in doing this.
What you've done with me, John.
Not that bad.
You're going to pass me off as a fellow.
But there's less than half an hour's time in these three things. The reason I mention all of this is because he, at an early stage in his career, he was working for Dutch television in a studio that had a lot of money poured into it, and he discovered that there was a magnificently equipped television studio that sat idle all morning every day, and he was able to maneuver himself into a position where he had the free use of it all by himself to play and to teach himself what it could do. And as a result, he learned how to do more with it than anybody else in the place who was using it seriously for what it was intended for, you know, later on. But this is just an extended analogy with what we're talking about, this gorgeous opportunity to play with things. I mean, that is the operative word, to play. Work doesn't produce nearly so much, such wonderful results as play.
Well, it's a secret, really, of running even a commercial magazine. You need a group of enthusiasts rather than wage slaves working for you, and you have to provide all sorts of opportunities to get together around a big table socially and start spewing out ideas which are meant to be funny or jokes, increasingly absurd. And you start high, and as you work your way down, you actually come up with real ideas that can be assigned as articles and are quite clever. But it all comes from a spirit of fun rather than the duty of turning in lists of seven ideas that are viable by 9 o'clock on Monday morning for everyone to vote on.
How could we persuade all those people to pay us for doing what we really would like to be doing for fun?
Well, that's really the trick, isn't it?
And it's, I come increasingly to the conclusion that the work that gets done, that lasts, that's important, that people remain interested in, are the things that people did out of marvelous spontaneity and
it's often true, but
along with the shit.
There are exceptions. There are exceptions to that. I mean, commercial art has produced some wonderful posters, illustrations for books and stories that were simply assigned as jobs to be done. And
I mean, you could cite the Sistine Chapel, for God's sake.
Well, that's right. It was a commissioned job. You know, I mean,
Sorry, sir, but my back is killing me.
Well, I can just remember back in college, they had at the Film Society where the tradition was to talk back to the screen. The agony and the ecstasy, the film about Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel and everything. And there was this scene where he had finished the Sistine Chapel and Rex Harrison is the Pope, and he's Pope of the moment, and he's coming to view it for the first time. And there's this little subtle music, Hollywood music score, pow, pow, bang, pow. And Harrison is looking at it and looking at it, and what is he going to think, you know? And there's this sort of music stops, and Harrison is still looking at it, and there's this long pause, and somebody from the audience shouts out, "Well, it's a little busy."
I wonder if it's thoughts like that that tipped Woody Allen off into A Purple Rose of Cairo.
I don't know. It's a pretty funny movie, though.
Oh, God. Love it. Is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have?
I really wouldn't know, but I do think that KPFA was an extraordinary place back in the early '60s. What you didn't go into, because I wasn't directly involved in it from a programming point of view, but we were certainly all involved in it socially, was the eruption of the free speech movement and the whole political scene at the time, which really was the first wave of the tidal wave that eventually swept over the country politically and for a time-changed landscape. And there we were. The station was intimately involved with that at the time that we were there. In fact, it was hard to know who was a participant and who was a reporter. They were so mixed up. And
yeah. Indeed.
Yeah. If one were doing a social history of Berkeley at the time that we were there, I mean, that would be the most significant thing that was going on, I'm sure.
Have you seen that television documentary?
Yeah, Berkeley in the 60s. Yeah, it wasn't bad.
My reaction, exactly. Not
was
bad.
Was really interesting to me because, you know, I mean, I've forgotten a lot. To see that, like Mario Savio, the legendary Mario Savio and others, when they went out to speak, were wearing coats and ties.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, that just blew my mind because I'd forgotten that completely. We were all part of this gentleman and lady culture, even if there was a revolution in the air. And it was all so polite.
Yeah.
So polite.
Yeah. Yeah, and also... You know, you see pictures of Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti and Corso in the 1950s, and half the time they're wearing neckties.
Yeah, yeah. It's very hard.
I'll tell you one thing that really blew me when I saw that film. I had a very, very strong memory of something that turned out to be wrong. And that was Mario Savio giving his famous speech, "Your time comes when you've got to throw yourself on the wheels and on the gears and so forth," which I absolutely remembering him delivering from on top of the police car, but he didn't.
No.
It was on the steps of Sproul Hall. And there was the film showing it.
There was another guy who was on top of the police car, Jack Goldberger, whomever. Mm-hmm.
I think that Mario may very well have been on top of that police car at one point while it was there, but that famous speech was not delivered from.
That there was all sorts of concern property might be damaged, and no one wanted to damage the police car. The idea was to use it to seize it, to keep it from moving, but don't damage it. Everyone was very polite.
Oh God.
We were political and cultural innocents, but revolution that people thought they made or were making, I think, didn't come to much. It had some impact on subsequent developments, but in retrospect, I mean, looking at where we are right now in the States, I mean, you can't believe that the 60s have made a lasting mark on things. But it was exhilarating at the moment. I do remember us being home at one point. My home was at a house in Berkeley, listening to KPFA on the radio, and Norman Mailer was making a speech and it was being carried live.
The Vietnam Day.
The Vietnam Day speech at Cal. And I'm listening and I'm hearing Norman Mailer saying, "Lyndon Johnson acts as if he's the only stud on a whorehouse, on a houseboat." And I'm thinking, oh my God in heaven, this is going to get the station in such hot water. The shit is going to start flying, and there's going to be an investigation and all of this. And sure enough, as I'm listening, the plug was pulled, but not before he got a chance to make stirring speech.
And it was me back in the studio pulling the plug.
Yeah, yeah.
Under orders.
Under orders, I'm sure.
Yeah. And I was furious.
Yeah, yeah. It was an incredible speech.
It was. And ultimately...
Mailer has been so good since.
God, I come on to London and go do an MA in American Lit here at the Institute of United States Studies, and I find myself reading Norman Mailer's Vietnam Day speech.
What a moment.